Thank you, James. Just to clear up one or two mundane matters before we start, I have more of notes with me tonight, so if you didn't get your set, you can collect them afterwards. It is intended for each class member to have a set of notes without charge, and then the quota which we have will fill the remainder in the library. I'm not going to read out of these notes or refer to them copiously, but you will find if you've read them that they constitute quite a full summary of all the things which we're going through, and they do entail a little bit more, but we're not actually going to rely upon them to read them. Well, brethren and sisters, last class we considered, following on from the conversion of Saul, that there was some 13 years of silence or darkness upon the life of that man as he went back home to his city Tarsus. And 12 years after his conversion, he came back down to Antioch because Barnabas had gone up and got him. For 12 months they embarked upon a preaching campaign, and then 13 years after the conversion of Saul, who became Paul, in 1847 they commenced their first missionary journey. We saw that on leaving the shores of Syria from the city Antioch, that the group of teachers and prophets who sent them off, giving them the moral support of the Antioch Ecclesia, actually in their names signified that they were to go forth and conquer the three races of the world, Ham, Shem and Japheth, and they were to do that on Gentile soil, just as we saw with the dispensation of Peter, that those three races were conquered on the soils of Judea. The first city which they went to on the island of Cyprus was of significance was Paphos, which we noted meant to boil. The name means to boil, and it indicates the completion of a process. And the process which was to be completed was the conception of this great vessel which was to become the light unto the Gentiles. And it was in Paphos that the conception process was completed, and we saw the birth of that little one, that little dwarf, the one whose name was Paul. And we noticed, brethren and sisters, that at that time, in the incident with Elymas the sorcerer, where Saul saw a reenactment of his own situation on the road to Damascus, that he desired to be known for what he had become. And as he looked upon a man whose name was Paulus, it had obviously come to his mind that his own Gentile name was Paul, and he desired to be known for what he had become and for not what he was. So he assumed his Gentile name, which is Paul, that means dwarfish, and of course fits perfectly the context of the parable, because now we see this little dwarf baby, as it was, having been born, with all the attention focusing in upon it, and the cries, as it were destined, as we'll see tonight, to turn the world upside down. We saw how Barnabas was in fact acting the part of a midwife, and constantly before the incident in Paphos it was always Barnabas and Saul. But after that incident the order was reversed, and we noticed then that Paul and Barnabas continued on, and Paul took the leading role. In chapters 13 and 14, which we just quickly passed over, you might remember that we showed that it had the flavour or the similarity to the Lord's own ministry. We remember that it was Christ who said in Mark chapter 1 and verse 38, he said, "Let us go into the next towns that I may preach there also. For therefore came I forth." And he preached in their synagogues throughout all Galilee and cast out devils or demons. Now when we look at Acts chapter 14 and verse 3, we see quite a similarity to that pattern, which says there, "Long time therefore abode they, speaking boldly in the Lord, which gave testimony unto the word of his grace, and granted signs and wonders to be done by their hands. So we find that the teaching of Paul was supported with these signs and wonders, even as it was the case with the Lord Jesus himself. In Colossians 1 and verse 23, it was Paul who said that he was to fill up that which is behind of the afflictions of Christ. We noted in this same section, in Acts chapter 14 and verse 19, for instance, that when he was at Lystra, that he was stoned in verse 19, and they drew him out of the city, supposing he had been dead. So he was actually symbolically killed there on the road at the gates of the city of Lystra. When we look down at verse 22, on his return trip through those cities, he exhorted in the midst of his enemies, he exhorted the ecclesias to continue in the faith, for he says that we must through much tribulation enter into the kingdom of God. So we find that Paul, who is as Christ to the Gentiles, was filling up that which was left behind of the afflictions of Christ. We noted that the basis of his message was Yahweh forgives through his Son, and that Paul's teachings were in fact God-centred. Now, we had a break-up of Acts chapter 13, which we won't look at now, but it is given in detail in the notes. You'll notice there that the break-up is dominantly God. God is the prime mover of all things. We then move into Acts chapter 16 to contemplate the work of Messiah in Philippi, and we looked at the betrayal and the death of Paul, symbolically speaking, of course. And tonight, God willing, we hope to then continue on and see the resurrection and the elevation of this same one. Now, we noted that contrary to our usual pattern, where we refer to the Acts as a basis for looking at the epistles, reversing that, we are using the epistles, the mind of Paul, to interpret the things which happened in Acts. And we asked you to have a little bookmark or something in Philippians chapter 2, which we'll perhaps do again tonight. We will refer back to here several times, so you place a marker in Philippians chapter 2. It's from this chapter that we pick up the essential keys to unlock Acts chapter 16. We notice in Philippians chapter 2 and beginning from verse 5, we covered these particular points where Paul says, and there is no shadow of a doubt that when Paul wrote these words, that the incidences which are recorded in Acts 16 were well and truly in his mind. Now he said, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God," or as it should be perhaps better rendered, "who being an expression of God," that means in character, "who being an expression of God, thought it not a thing to be grasped at," as it should be rendered, "to be equal with God." Now we noticed, didn't we, brethren and sisters, that this verse had a particular application to Paul, because as he travelled across the territory of Galatia, commencing on his second journey, he was mindful to enter into Asia, but the Spirit forbade him. We noticed out of the incident of the argument with Barnabas and Paul when they split up, that argument took place, and it was quite a heated argument, it took place as a result of the good qualities of both. Barnabas, whose name means the son of consolation, one who tries to heal wounds, and Paul, who was particularly careful in the selection of his personnel, in the places that he went to preach the gospel, he was very, very careful to make sure that whatever he did was precise and effective. Now, Paul had first-hand information of that lower section of Asia. He knew it well. His intention was to go into Asia. That's where it would be profitable. Now, against his better judgments and his own experience, he became subservient to the Spirit, which directed him up north. And so as he travelled up north towards Bithynia, again the Spirit forbade him there and directed him eastward, or rather westward, across to Troas. On each occasion, although he was now constituted the vessel of the Lord to bear his name, although he was, as it were, Christ to the Gentiles, and there would be no shadow of a doubt, brethren and sisters, that Paul understood his mission as that, although he had this elevated position, yet he became subservient to God. He thought it not a thing to be grasped at, to be made equal with the authority of God. And so it is in Philippians that Saul, or Paul rather, found himself in Troas, and then again the Spirit directed him across the waters to Philippi. So we read then in verse 7, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. Now on reaching the city of Philippi, we found that that city had no synagogue in it. There were very few Jews, and of those Jews who dwelt in that city, they were only women. We noticed also that according to the Greek culture, and we'll be looking at this point again later on, that women were accounted as nothing in status. So this little group of Jewish women, in the eyes of the world, would have been absolutely nothing. They had no synagogue. All they did was sheltered in a little old humpy of stone down on the banks of the river. And this great one, Christ to the Gentiles, humbled himself. He took upon himself the form of a man. He humbled himself. He became obedient to God's desires, and he found himself with this little group of women. And then in verse 8 we read on that, being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And as the events of Acts chapter 16 took us on, we found that Paul came into conflict, first of all, with that business syndicate who had the manipulation of that slave girl who was a Pythoness. She was a ventriloquist. She was reputed to speak the oracles of Delphi, and she was acclaimed, as it were, to be inspired. Now, Paul took exception to that. He found himself in conflict with the business syndicate and eventually with the magistrates of that city. We noted that, first of all, he was taken to the civil magistrates. When they couldn't deal with him, they passed him on then to the supreme magistrates, the governors from Rome. Just as it was in the case of the Lord, where when he was taken during his betrayal, he was first of all taken to the house of the high priest, and then he was passed over to the Romans and taken before Pilate. Finally, of course, the Lord was crucified, and Paul and Silas were strapped to the public whipping posts. After they had been stripped naked, they were exposed to the shame and the humiliation in the open court, the agora. And then they were thrashed with the lictor's rods, which were tipped with metal tips upon leather thongs. And as we mentioned, that Paul said that thrice he was beaten above measure, which meant that you can start from 40 and count on as to how many lashings they received. Having their backs pulped up and mutilated, and certainly would have been an ugly mess, we read then, coming back now to Acts chapter 16, that they were now symbolically dead. And in Acts chapter 16 and verse 23 we read, and when they had laid many stripes upon them, they cast them into prison, charging the jailer to keep them safely, who, having received such a charge, thrust them into the inner prison and made their feet fast in the stocks. They were thrown into the inner prison, which was a dungeon, so that Paul and Silas were now down underneath the ground in the, what is known as the maximum security area. And to add insult to injury, their legs were stretched across logs, which these stocks were, and they were roped so that they were stretched apart and placed in the most uncomfortable position, so that their mutilated backs would have rested upon the damp soil of the dungeon. And from a natural point of view, it must have been excruciating agony. However, we are to face, brothers and sisters, a resurrection. And we read there in verses 25 and 26, "And at midnight, Paul and Silas prayed and sang praises unto God, and the prisoners heard them. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prisons were shaken, and immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's hands were loosed." So that we find that they prayed and they sang praises. You know, it was Peter who recorded in his first epistle at chapter 2 and verse 23, a reference which we've already referred to, but it was Peter who said that at the height of the Lord's affliction, when he was brutally crucified upon the cross, that he committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. As we saw from Acts chapter 8, he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter. And now here we have the Apostle Paul, having been subjected to this extreme form of affliction, was now committing himself unto Yahweh. They were praying and singing praises. They weren't trying to justify themselves. Each of them had the rights of Roman citizenship. They could have avoided that, but they opened not their mouths to justify themselves. And we noticed, brothers and sisters, it was midnight. And in the Gentile order of times, as we are accustomed, midnight commences the beginning of a new day. This was the beginning of a new day. And perhaps we could take up the importance of this back in Matthew chapter 28, where we read the account of the Lord's own resurrection. In Matthew chapter 28, I'm looking at verse 1. Now it says here in verse 1, "In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulchre. It was at the time of the commencement of a new day." It was at the end of the Sabbath and the beginning of the first day of the week. So we have here a parallel situation, the beginning of a new day. And we read in verse 2, "And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. And his countenance was like lightning and his raiment white as snow. And for fear of him, the keepers did shake and became as dead men." When we come back to Acts chapter 16 and take up the parallel account in relation to Paul, we find that it was at midnight, brethren and sisters, and Luke is quite particular to tell us an important little point where he says the prisoners heard them. And the expression which he uses here indicates a continuous and an attentive hearing. In other words, they were listening with understanding to the praises and the prayers of those two men. And all this is occurring at midnight, when in verse 26 we read, "And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately all the doors were opened, and everyone's bands were loosed. Immediately there was a great earthquake, which we saw, of course, in Matthew 28, the similarity to the Lord's own resurrection. Now it was by the means of this shaking of the earthquake that the cords of death, the bands by which they were lashed to those logs, were released. And not only that, the pins and the staples fell apart, so causing the doors to swing open and make a free access away from that prison. But we notice, brethren and sisters, also that the cords having been loosed, that it was now possible for those prisoners to stand upon their feet. That they were to go through an anastasis, a standing up of the dead ones, because this is now a symbolic resurrection. And having gone through that resurrection, brethren and sisters, in verses 27 to 32, we read now of a little cameo relating to the power of the risen Christ. Now we saw the power of the risen Christ in action in the case of Saul on the road to Damascus. We are now going to see Paul himself in the place, as it were, of the risen Christ, and to see the effects of his resurrection upon the keeper of that prison. And so we read in verse 27, "And the keeper of the prison, awaking out of his sleep, and seeing the prison doors open, he drew out his sword and would have killed himself, supposing that the prisoners had been fled. But Paul cried with a loud voice, saying, Do thyself no harm, for we are all here. Then he called for a light, and sprang in, and came trembling, and fell down before him and Silas, and brought them out, and said, Sirs, what must I do to be saved? And they said, Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved, and thy house. And they spake unto him the word of the Lord, and all that were in his house." So we find then that in verse 27, awaking out of his sleep. Now he was in a sleep, brethren and sisters, and it's the Apostle Paul who, when he journeyed some 100 miles further down the coast of Thessalonica, and wrote to that ecclesia, he described sleep as a spiritual death. He looked upon the sleep of a person, as in the case of the jailer, as being spiritually dead. And that furthermore, when he wrote to the Ephesians, he mentioned the expression in chapter 2 that one is dead in his trespasses and sins. So here is a keeper, a jailer, who was dead in trespasses and sins. But at the resurrection of the risen Christ, that is Paul himself, he awoke from that situation, and his immediate reaction was to kill himself, to take his life. Now under the Roman system of things, a jailer was responsible for the security of his prisoners with his own life. For instance, in Acts chapter 12 and verse 19, 16 jailers, 4 quaternions of soldiers, lost their lives because Peter was led out of that prison by the angel. Again, another little cameo of a death and a resurrection, at that time in the case of Peter. So it is that the jailer wants to commit suicide. He knows that death is the only lot left in life now. And it was the practice amongst jailers or keepers that suicide was a dignified answer to their failure and embarrassment. It was a dignified answer to his situation of hopelessness. And so the jailer had come to realise now that he was utterly hopeless, that death was the reward of his works. And he became, in the type that we're looking at, an awakened sinner. Now we have all gone through that phase in our lives, brethren and sisters, when we realise that without the covering of Christ, we are sinners without hope. And here is the jailer now, having realised his hopeless state, now viewing the risen Christ. Paul said in verse 28, he said, "Do thyself no harm." Now it was Paul who cried with a loud voice. And it was Paul who anticipated what that jailer was going through. I don't believe he could see him. Some commentators say that he could see him in the moonlight from out of the depths of the dungeons. I don't believe that. I believe he heard the shriek of utter confusion it was anarchy, really, in the mind of that man. He was just screaming because he knew that all that was left to him was death. And perhaps that might be our own reaction, brethren and sisters, if we stood in that situation, knowing that the death is not far away. So he was panic-stricken. He was terrified. And so Paul sang out with a loud voice, "Do thyself no harm." And as that voice came floating out of that prison, brethren and sisters, it was to that jailer the word of life. It was to that jailer the word of life. Because Paul had anticipated his suicide. He knew that in the dignity of jailers it was customary for them to commit suicide. And that jailer had his knife or his sword ready. And his answer was, "We are all here. Do thyself no harm, for we are all here." And that's an interesting little expression. Because Luke is showing us that in that situation, Paul was totally in command and supreme. That the other prisoners who were with him in the dungeon were still with him when the gates had opened wide. And Paul is seen here in total and cool and supreme command. We are all here. Now, you would know as well as I do, and perhaps I might even know better than some of you, because I've been in a prison, not locked up, but I've worked in a prison down up here at Yatla. And two chaps that I taught up there, both of them escaped. And one of them virtually told me the night before he went, because he gave me a present and wished me well. But you see, you only have to put enough gap in the gate for a prisoner to get through, and he's gone. There's no staying in a prison. When they see freedom before them, brothers and sisters, they're gone. But here is a situation where Paul had supreme command over those men, and they were all there. No one had escaped. Now we're going to see some tremendous implications in that a little later on. So we'll press on, and in verse 29 we read, "Then he called for a light and sprang in and came trembling and fell down before Paul and Silas." So the first thing he did was he called for a light. Now in the Greek, the word light is in the plural. He called for lights, more than one, and possibly a number of torches were brought in by his attendants. So there was this group of lights which were brought in. And the jailer himself sprang in and came trembling. And the expression literally means being terror-stricken. Now this man is almost out of his mind. He's terror-stricken. He's thoroughly shaken, brethren and sisters, mentally, morally, and physically. Or if you like, emotionally, mentally, and physically. He was thoroughly shaken because he was now symbolically beholding the risen Christ. He was shaken like that same man 17 years before on the road to Damascus. In type, the jailer was beholding the risen Christ, and it had now become his moment of truth. And it is true in our own lives, brethren and sisters, that we go through a similar process wherein we come to a moment of truth in our lives that causes us to be convinced that there is a risen Christ in heaven and that Yahweh is a reality indeed. And this was the jailer's moment of truth. And so Luke tells us that he fell down before Paul, which was an act of profound respect. It was, as it were, a symbolic death to his life of trespass and sin. He was prostrated to the ground before the risen Christ, as Saul was 17 years before. Now there is no resemblance here of the pride of the authority which is characteristic of all jailers. If you have ever observed these characters that go up here to the prison and work as jailers, every single one of them are proud, and every single one of them are hungry for power and authority. And they treat men up there like dogs, and they love it. And that is the characteristic of jailers. But here is a man who has been emptied of all of that, and he is now prostrated upon the ground before one of his prisoners, whom I believe now he saw as more than a prisoner, but he saw him as a divine officer, if you like, and perhaps later, when he was educated, came to see him as Christ to the Gentiles. Now in verse 30, the jailer says that he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And that word "sirs" is the same word that Saul himself used when he said "Lord" on the road to Damascus. It was a term of respect. It's the title Kyrios, or Kyrioi as it is here. So he was respecting Paul as one sent of God, even as Saul on the road to Damascus recognized the sight of the Lord on the road. As he didn't recognize him as Jesus at that stage, but he did recognize him as being divinely sent. And so he says, "What must I do to be saved?" Now that is not an expression which relates to his physical safety. That trauma had now passed. That expression is a confession of his needs. He has now become an awakened sinner. So he's not referring to his physical safety, but rather he is indicating his readiness to accept the atoning truth. He has been brought to that point of advance in the process of his conversion. And so we read in verse 31, "And they said, 'Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved in thine house.' And they spake unto him all the word of the Lord, and to all that were in his house." Now we notice, of course, the expression "to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ." They were indicating that what he had to do now was to accept the principles of the atonement. The principles that we read of in Acts chapter 8, which were purely and simply an expression of Isaiah 53. So what Paul is saying is, you've got to learn Isaiah 53. You've got to come to understand what the atonement, or the sin-covering name of Christ, is all about. Now Luke is also careful to tell us that it wasn't only going to be the jailer who was saved, but all thy house. And that is calculated to indicate to our minds, brothers and sisters, that this was going to be a properly constituted conversion. Because you see, right from the beginning, Yahweh intended the truth to be family-centred. Israel was only as strong as the family units that made up the nation. And here we have the indication that there was going to be a complete and a properly constituted conversion. And so we read on then in verse 33, "And he took them the same hour of the night and washed their stripes and was baptized, he and all his straightway. And when he had brought them into his house, he set meat before them and rejoiced, believing in God with all his house." The same hour of the night, which would have been the same hour, brethren and sisters, when he had come to a responsible knowledge of the atonement. And without any shadow of a doubt. That jailer received an exposition of Isaiah chapter 53. Because having come to a responsible understanding of that, the same hour of the night, in other words, there was no procrastination here, the jailer washed their stripes. And Isaiah in chapter 53 and verses 4 to 8 says, with his stripes are we healed. Now there would have been no shadow of a doubt that that jailer would have been eagerly awaiting to be baptized. But he forbade that until he had washed their stripes. Now there was no necessity for him to wash the stripes of the apostles before he was baptized in a physical sense. He washed their stripes in acknowledgement of the atoning principles of Isaiah 53. So here is another man, like an Ethiopian eunuch, like a man called Saul on the road to Damascus, who had been thoroughly educated in the principles of the atonement. And so upon that basis, brethren and sisters, acknowledging Paul also as Christ to the Gentiles, he would have seen in the apostle that there was the suffering servant manifested amongst the Gentiles. Having washed his stripes, he was then straightway baptized, as Luke tells us in verse 33. Now his baptism is mentioned here in relation to the stripes. Having washed their stripes, straightway they were baptized, indicating, brethren and sisters, that baptism is purely and simply a symbolic reenactment of all that had taken place from the great shaking of the earthquake until he was now ready to be plunged into the water. And so he was promptly immersed, and he became, brethren and sisters, now a brother to Paul and to Silas. And with that new status and relationship, in verse 34 we read, and when he had brought them into his house, he set meat before them and rejoiced. Now he brought them into his house. They were now brethren and sisters in the household of God. And they entered into there, brethren and sisters, to partake of a fellowship meal. And the jailer is here seen as rejoicing. And you know, of course, brethren and sisters, there were two others who rejoiced when they had found the truth, when they had seen the risen Christ, one in faith and one literally, a eunuch and Saul. And having both been educated in the principles of the atonement, having come to understand, brethren and sisters, and have a sound practical conviction of God manifestation, they were able to rejoice. They never saw the truth as deprivation. How easy it is to see the truth as something which says you've got to give up this, and no longer can you do that, and you can't go there anymore. But rather, we should see the truth as these men saw it, to rejoice in the hope which has been given us, having a vision of the age to come. And so having come to that principle of life, they were now going to walk according to this rule. As God is, so are we in this world. That's the conviction to which they've come, brethren and sisters. And that little expression which I just mentioned is coined by John in his first epistle in about chapter 4 when he is defining agape love and our confidence which we shall have at the judgment seat. As God is, so are we in this world. And there is a simple definition of God manifestation, and that is the conviction to which these men have come, because they had now seen for themselves the power of the risen Christ. Now, while we are at this stage, I'd like you to turn back to your bookmark in Philippians chapter 2 and see how Paul continues the story. in Philippians chapter 2, and we'll look at verse 12 at this stage. Now, as I read through this, try and pick up the familiar expressions. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Now, if there was ever an ecclesia which would have understood the meaning of that expression, it was the brethren and sisters at Philippi. Because there was a man who came in with great fear and trembling and was prostrated before Christ to the Gentiles. And so he goes on, he says, for it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do his good pleasure. Do all things without murmurings and disputings, that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain, neither laboured in vain. Now, if you were observant, you would have noticed quite a number of expressions which directly relate to the incidences which occurred in Philippi. That they were to be blameless. There was to be no murmurings and disputations. There were two men in a jail, brethren and sisters. Both of them had been falsely accused. Both of them had been thoroughly lashed. Yet there was no disputation about that. There was no crying for justice. There was no self-defense. They were blameless and they were harmless, the sons of God. We saw the mention of the crooked and the perverse generation. The business syndicate. That mob of crooks who used that young lass for purely and simply their own monetary gain. We notice also here the expression, to shine forth as lights in the world. And remember, I was careful to point out that in Acts 16, when the jailer brought in a light, the Greek is lights, plural. Paul is now telling the ecclesia that they were to go forth as lights in a dark age and hold forth the word of life. Do thyself no harm. Was the word of life. We notice also here the expression, to shine forth as lights in the world. And remember, I was careful to point out that in Acts 16, when the jailer brought in a light, the Greek is lights, plural. Paul is now telling the ecclesia that they were to go forth as lights in a dark age and hold forth the word of life. Do thyself no harm. Was the word of life to that jailer. And there was certainly a man in that ecclesia who well and truly understood that expression. And so we can see, brethren and sisters, how closely the incidents in Philippi are related to Paul's expression in his letter here. And we're not completed yet either. But before we can have a little further look in Philippians 2, I want you to come back to Acts chapter 16 and just continue the story. In verse 35, we have now the section from verse 35 to the end of the chapter, which we might put under the theme or the heading, unto him every knee shall bow and every tongue confess. When it was day, says Luke in verse 35, recording the incidents, when it was day, the magistrates sent the sergeant, saying, let those men go. And the keeper of the prison told this saying to Paul, the magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace. But Paul said unto them, they have beaten us openly, uncondemned, being Romans, and have cast us into prison, and now they do thrust us out privily? Nay, verily, but let them come themselves and fetch us out. And the sergeants told these words unto the magistrates, and they feared when they heard that they were Romans. So we read then in verse 35, when it was dark. When it was day. Now this particular day, brethren and sisters, in the theme refers to the millennial day. And we have now here a cover-up, which we see, of course, back in Matthew, when the Lord's body was resurrected and no longer to be found in the tomb. There was the Roman cover-up. They said that his body had been stolen, and they endeavoured to exempt themselves from any sort of blame or any sort of confession that there had been a resurrection. Now here we have the magistrates sent along the sergeants. Now they were the lictors. They were the characters who had the delight in thrashing those two men. Now they were coming along, brethren and sisters, to attempt to spare the pride and civil dignity of those magistrates, to undo, if you like, the catalogue of errors. So they had come. The earthquake, of course, and we've sort of moved on a fair bit, haven't we, from that earthquake, but bearing in mind, the earthquake was at midnight, and this was first thing the next morning. And the reason why is because earthquakes were regarded by those folk as omens of the gods. In other words, they associated the imprisonment of Paul and Silas and the earthquake together. And they saw it as an omen, or the anger of the gods. And on that basis, they sent their sergeants. Now, these magistrates, in the parable or the type that we are looking at, represent the principalities and the powers of the Roman heavens. They are the rulers, they are the heavenlies, the principalities and the powers. Now that expression is quite important to store away in our minds. Now in verse 36 we read, and the keeper of the prison told this saying to Paul. So that, you see, Paul had now suddenly changed his status and his standing in Philippi. The keeper told this saying to Paul, the magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace. And you know, you can imagine, brethren and sisters, the sheer delight on that jailer's face. Because obviously Paul and Silas returned back to the dungeon on a different basis than when they were originally thrown in there. They would have been far more comfortable having returned from the jailer's house. But you can imagine, here was the pronouncement of freedom for those two men, and the jailer would have gone in there with glee, only to find that the apostle stood his ground. And he did it for a very special reason. In verse 37, Paul says, but Paul said unto them, they have beaten us openly, uncondemned, being Romans, and have cast us into prison, and now do they thrust us out privily? No, verily, but let them come themselves and fetch us out. Now you see, when Paul and Silas were accused, they were accused on the basis that Christianity was unlawful. They were teaching customs and doctrines which were not lawful to accept. Now Paul was going to make sure that by the time he left that prison, that it was well and truly known to those magistrates, because this Philippi was a colonial city, it was a little Rome. So whatever was established in Philippi was also good in Rome. He was going to make sure that Christianity was seen as a legal religion, that it was not unlawful. But the implications go much further than that. Because you see, the whole situation had turned, and Paul was now seen to be in supreme authority or control. Because you see, the Romans had a law which was given in BC 508, and it was known as the Valerian Law. And this Valerian Law had a penalty, the lightest of which was to confiscate every possession that a person had, or the heaviest penalty for that law was death itself. Now, the law involved treating a Roman citizen against the rights which he had. Now, Paul mentions the catalogue of errors here in verse 37. He says they've beaten the apostles publicly, they've forbidden them a trial of defence, which was perfectly their rights, because they were Roman citizens, as he mentions next. They had thrown them into prison, which they should never have done. And not only that, they are now trying to deceitfully cover up. Now, there's a catalogue of sins, if there were ever one. And these magistrates, according to the Valerian law, could now be subjected to the penalty, the minimum of which was the confiscation of all their possessions, to the maximum of death. So Paul had, as it were, the power of death in his own hands. And had he pressed those charges, that penalty could have been exacted upon those magistrates. So you see now, Paul has supreme power over the Roman magistrates, the heavenlies of the Roman Empire, if you like. He has supreme power over the jailer, having brought him into the truth, and he had supreme authority over the prisoners who were in the dungeon. Now you come back to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, and we'll continue our story from, we'll start from verse 8, so that we gain our context. Philippians 2 verse 8. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him, and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow, or should bow, of things in heaven, the Roman heavenlies or principalities, the magistrates, and things in earth, the jailer, and things under the earth, the prisoners. And you have each of those three categories mentioned. And in the case of Acts chapter 16, the apostle had supreme control over each one of those situations. A man prostrated on the ground before him. What must I do to be saved? A group of magistrates, crooks they were, he's now going to make them bow down before him and confess. And a bunch of prisoners who would have gladly shot through those open doors but remained subservient to him. He is now seen in supreme control. He has been highly exalted. And so we read in verse 11, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And so in a cameo form, or a parable form, we see how that the Apostle Paul had enacted the work of Messiah in Philippi. Now, returning back to the last few verses of chapter 16, we read in verse 38, and the sergeants told these words unto the magistrates, and they feared when they heard that they were Romans. You see, they were now fearful of their lives. And they came and besought them and brought them out and desired them to depart out of the city. And the expression is quite flowing, isn't it? They sought them, they brought them, they desired them to depart out of the city. Because until they got those men out of the way, they feared for their very lives. And you know, that's quite reminiscent, isn't it, brothers and sisters, of the words of Isaiah 24. We're not going to turn out of that very much, but perhaps this is one reference we could look at. In Isaiah 24, we have one of those cameos of the kingdom age, where the Lord Jesus Christ, the true Messiah, is seen to be in this relationship. In Isaiah 24, and we'll start from verse 21, Isaiah says, speaking of the last days when the nations shall be humbled, he says, "And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth, and they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit or the dungeon, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days shall they be visited. Then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed, when Yahweh of armies shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously." And so we shall see, as it were, the heavenlies of this age, the ruling bodies, the governments of the nations, shall, as it were, be imprisoned. They shall be shut up. They shall no longer exercise their authority in the earth. And so we see here in the vision of Isaiah, in the words of Isaiah, a description of the literal fulfilment of what we have seen here in Acts chapter 16 in parable form. Now in verse 40 of Acts 16, we have the final comment upon the incidents in Philippi. "And when they went out of the prison," that's Paul and Silas, "and entered into the house of Lydia, and when they had seen the brethren, they comforted them and departed." And surely, brethren and sisters, it wouldn't take much imagination to see the excitement and the joy of Paul's victory in Philippi. It would have been a sheer delight and a testimony to the power of Yahweh to meet there with a brother and his household, one who was a jailer, one who was dead in his trespasses and sins, and now a member of the Philippian ecclesia. It would have been a delightful situation indeed. And perhaps some of those occasions would remind us of that 149th Psalm, where we have one of those occasions of victory and of joy, of song and praise to Yahweh, because there the saints will have taken the two-edged sword and they shall have enchained the governments of this world and humbled the nations. And it's one of those little incidents which remind us of that situation that we delight and we look forward to. But perhaps in concluding chapter 16, we might turn back to Philippians chapter 1 and verse 27. And these words, brothers and sisters, could well have formed the subject, or at least part of the subject, of Paul's parting words. For he says in verse 27, he says, "Only let your conversation be as it becometh the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you, or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that ye stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, and in nothing terrified by your adversaries, which is to them an evident token of perdition, but to you of salvation, and that of God. For unto you it is given in that behalf of Christ, not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake, having the same conflict which ye saw in me, and now here to be in me." And whilst there's no doubt about it that he is speaking from Rome, and there are the super impressions of the pictures of Rome there, there is also that memory of Paul's occasion with them in Philippi in chapter 16. They had seen him suffer, and now for Christ's sake they were going to stand together, united in one mind, and they were not going to be terrified by their adversaries, but that they were going to accept the afflictions of Christ for his sake and for the glory of God. And so we have seen, brethren and sisters, hidden as it were beneath the surface of the Acts, the record of the death, burial and the resurrection of Messiah to the Gentiles, and also we have seen his elevation and the subjection of all powers unto him. Now our time is moving on, but I would like to try and take the opportunity to deal very briefly with chapter 17 in just a few minutes. Now, I'm not going to go through this in detail, but chapter 17 follows on the theme, and reasonably, I suppose, chronologically, but it is calculated to show us the conquest of the gospel over the what might be the enemies of the truth. Now, the Lord, of course, having assumed his authority in the earth, it remains now to see how the power of the gospel can overcome atheism, or if you like, idolatry, paganism, all of these isms which exist in the earth. And to see that the gospel is supreme in being able to do that. Now, as I said, we just want to capture the spirit of chapter 17 and, of course, not deal with it verse by verse. But we want to show, again, some of the hidden gems which are underneath the surface of the record. When Paul left Philippi, he travelled down here something like about 100 miles to Thessalonica, and then from Thessalonica down to Berea, a distance of about another 30 miles. And from Berea, he then travelled down to Athens. So that immediately after leaving Philippi, in Acts chapter 17, he passed through three cities, Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. Now, it's interesting that Luke mentions those three cities in the way he does. Because in those three cities, he is representing to our mind every walk of life. The city of Thessalonica was a cosmopolitan commercial port. It was one of those cities which buzzed with business, if you like. It was active, and along with all its business pursuits was the moral corruption as well. And then when he came down to Berea, he came down to a peaceful, slow-moving, tranquil country city where everybody lived peacefully. And we read, of course, in verse 11, where there was an entirely different spirit. For he says, these were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind, and searched the scriptures daily, whether those things were so. Here we have a picture of a city, a different phase of life altogether, where people had time to do their daily reading, where people had time to think about the scriptures. And so he's representing a different walk of life. And then he came down to Athens, which of course was the most celebrated city of Greece. It was the large, sprawling, urban city-type situation. And Athens was distinguished for its military talents, for its learning, for its eloquence, for its human culture or cultural arts. It was an elite city in the world. It was reputed to have produced the most celebrated soldiers, poets, statesmen and philosophers, men like Socrates and Plato and so on. So it was no mean city, and it represented that phase of life. So he has produced to our minds, that is Luke in this record, three cities which speak of every walk of life. Now in those three cities, in each of them, the truth or the gospel had its conquering victory. Now in the case of Thessalonica, in verse 4 we read, and some of them believed. Now that relates to the Jews. Some of the Jews believed and consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks, a great multitude, and of the chief women, not a few. So you see, the influence of the truth has been quite considerable in this busy cosmopolitan city. When we come down to Berea, we read in verse 12, "Therefore, many of them believed, also of honourable women which were Greeks, and of men, not a few." So you see, the truth made a tremendous impact in that little quiet country town, that little secluded, out-of-the-way place. It had a considerable impact upon a rural population. And then in Athens, in verse 34 we read, "Howbeit, certain men clave unto him and believed, among the which was Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them." So the truth had its conquest in Athens also. Three different types or walks of life, and the truth in each occasion had its victory. Now, along with the victories of the truth also came the opposition of violence. And there was the violence seen in each of the three cities. Now, in this situation, the Apostle Paul set forth in chapter 17, in regard to violence, he set forth the spirit of Messiah, which was recorded by Isaiah in chapter 42 and verses 1 to 3. We'll just quickly turn over there. Chapter 42. Isaiah 42 and verse 1. This, of course, is part of the servant prophecy relating to Christ or Messiah. Isaiah says, "Behold my servant," recording the words of Yahweh, of course, "behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him, and he shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. He shall bring forth truth to the Gentiles," as Matthew records it. So he was one who was going to bring forth truth to the Gentiles. Now, of course, the Lord, when he returns, will literally do that. But Paul, in the parable form, is doing it in the record of the Acts. Now, verse 2 tells us, "He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street." Now, that's an interesting expression which he uses. And the analogy which he has taken is one of a house fight, where there's an argument, and the raised voices can be heard in the street as one shouts against another in the course of an argument. But you see, the voice of argument, the voice of opposition, was not going to be heard in that man at that stage. But rather, it was going to be the soft, persuasive word. And so we read in verse 3, "A bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax shall he not quench. He shall bring forth judgment unto truth, and he shall not fail nor be discouraged till he hath set judgment in the earth, and the isle shall wait for his law." So in other words, the first advent of the Lord was seen to be one of carefully nurturing even the weakest interest and enthusiasm for the truth. Now that was Paul's spirit here in Acts chapter 17 in returning back. For you see, in verse 5, as far as Thessalonica was concerned, we read that the Jews which believed not, moved with envy, took unto them certain lewd fellows of the baser sort, and gathered a company and set all the city on an uproar, and assaulted the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people. Now, having assaulted the house of Jason, Jason and the ecclesia were put under an agreement that that they could continue to have their freedom provided Paul was out of the city. So on that basis, the ecclesia, unfortunately, and much to Paul's grief, had to send him away, and he went down to Berea. Now, when he was in Berea, in verse 13 we read, "When the Jews of Thessalonica had knowledge that the word of God was preached of Paul at Berea, they came thither also and stirred up the people, and then immediately the brethren had to send Paul away." So you see, he spoke the truth, the violent opposition came, but he backed away. He never confronted it. His voice was not going to be heard in the street, in the sense that Isaiah mentioned it. And likewise in verse 18, down in Athens, then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and the Stoics encountered him, and some said, "What will this babbler say?" Others, "Some, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him unto the Areopagus. Now that expression, "and they took him," means that they physically grabbed him and they dragged him up to Mars Hill. Now when an educated professor, if you like, an eloquent man grabs his opponent and drags him up to the high court of the city, then he is aroused with hatred and enmity. And so Paul suffered the violence in Athens in perhaps a slightly different way, but it was still there. Now, we find then that in the record of Luke, and I just want to bring this to a climax, in the record of Luke, Luke hurries our minds through the record of what took place in Thessalonica, Berea, and down to Athens. And then he spends some time around what took place in Athens to show us the conquest of truth, as it were, an epitome of all the types of opposition that there could be. Now in Athens, Paul was taken to the Areopagus on Mars Hill, which was the most celebrated platform of court in the world. It was, as it were, the highest platform on which there could take place the contest between truth and error. And truth is going to be seen to have the victory. Now it is sometimes said that Paul, his speech on Mars Hill was a flop. It is sometimes seen that he was one time when Paul seemed to fail miserably. Now, depending how you look at that, but from a natural point of view, you could accept that perhaps. But you see, Luke is intending us to look further than that. He is intending us to take a spiritual point of view and to see the hidden secrets of Yahweh. The victory of the truth in chapter 17 was numerically small, but from a spiritual point of view, it was profound. Now, I just want to paint very quickly for you the picture of the battle and the outcome of it. But before we can do that, perhaps to save time, I might just say this instead of write it up. In the first of Peter, chapter 4, and verses 17 and 18, which you can look at later or you might remember it, where Peter says that judgment must first begin at the household of God, right, and then it will extend to the world. And in that context of judgment, he mentions three classes of people. Now, God looks down upon the earth and he sees all mankind according to three groups of people. There are the righteous. "If the righteous scarcely be saved," said Peter. There is the ungodly. And there is the sinner. Now, there are your three classes of people. The righteous, the ungodly, and the sinner. Now the ungodly is the militant atheist. He is the out and out opposer of God. The sinner is one who should know better. He is a religious person, but he does not walk according to the righteousness of God. He might be described as a religious atheist. He opposes God in his way of life. So that this world can be seen to be divided into three groups: the righteous, the ungodly, and the sinner; the righteous, or the militant atheist, or the religious atheist. Now, when Paul came into contest between these other two groups, the atheists, he came up against the Epicureans and the Stoics in verse 18. We read here, "Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him." Now these were the two schools of philosophy which existed in Athens. And they were two celebrated groups. Now, the Epicureans represent militant atheists or the ungodly, and the Stoics represent the religious atheist or the sinner. Now, these two ideologies are opposing. There was as much agreement between Epicureans and Stoics as there is between communists and Catholics. They are diametrically opposed in their ideologies. Now, these two groups found it expedient to come together for the contest against the truth. And so they dragged Paul up to Mars Hill. Now, the remainder of the chapter tells us about the encounter. But before we look at the results of the encounter, and not so much the argument, because we probably know it well, just a few words about Epicureans and about Stoics. The Epicurean was an atheist, indeed, because he believed that the world was simply formed by an accidental concourse of atoms. So he was totally and utterly a militant atheist. He would have nothing to do with the slightest suggestion that there was a divine hand behind creation. His philosophy was pleasure and hedonism. In other words, eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow you die. So his life was one of getting in and enjoying himself to the fullest before he died. And you can imagine that that form of life was one of sheer revelry. Eat, drink and be merry. Forget who you hurt, forget what laws you break, just enjoy yourself while you've got life. That was his philosophy. Now the Stoics, they were a different brand. Whilst there are more we could say about each, I just want to mention those couple of salient points because our time is moving on. The Stoic was a different brand. The Stoics arose from a chap called Zeno who migrated from Cyprus to Athens, and when he came to Athens he was appalled by the corruption which existed there. So he set himself about to try and resist or stem the tide of corruption, and to do it upon the basis of human discipline. Human discipline. Now, he wasn't a militant atheist. He did indicate that he felt that the world was some sort of a soul, or the world in itself was a god which was able to sort of multiply. He attributed some divine influence to creation, but he wouldn't suggest any more than that. So in other words, he's a little bit like a theistic evolutionist. He's a little bit like the common Christian of today. But his philosophy, brethren and sisters, was one of a virtuous self-denial. And by exercising that sort of restraint in his life and in the lives of those who followed him, he would bring to bear a measure of law and order, or a measure of morality, to the society of Athens. That was his chief design. So his philosophy then is one of discipline, if you like, taming the instinct of our nature. Now, there are two systems which are diametrically opposed. One says, eat, drink and be merry. The other says, discipline your life. Walk orderly. Now, it was the Stoic who claimed that he was the paragon of virtue. If you want to behold virtue, then you look at me. That was his brand of life. Now, let's turn across to the end of the chapter and see what the outcome of the battle was. Remember now, it was a contest between the truth, between Paul, and these two schools of philosophy which had found it expedient to join together in opposing the truth. Now, the thought which brought the contest to an end came in verse 32. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked and others said, "We will hear thee again of this matter." But the resurrection of the dead stemmed out of Paul's statement in verse 31, where he says that God had appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, and that he hath raised him from the dead. So the context is one of judgment, one of sorting out. And now this whole situation is going to be sorted out. And after the contest that was broken up, some mocking, some saying, well, we'll hear you again sometime when we have a spare moment. We read in verse 33, so Paul departed from among them. But the most important verse of the whole chapter, and almost cursory, put in by Luke, howbeit, despite all that had happened, certain men clave unto him and believed. Among the which was Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. So he tells us that out of that incident came a group of believers. In other words, the truth had had its victory. But he defines the limits of that victory, brethren and sisters, because out of the little group, he singles forth one man and one woman. Now why should he tell us that Dionysius and Damaris were among that little group who were converted? Well, he does it to tell us, brethren and sisters, that in that contest, the truth had the absolute victory over those philosophies of the world. Now, Dionysius is a Greek name which means the reveller. And he represents the Epicureans. His name is synonymous with the god Bacchus. This is where Dionysius and Bacchus are the same. Have the same origins, and Bacchus was the god of wine or the god of the vineyards, so that by extension you can see the idea of revelry coming from the wine and the vineyards and the product of it. So Dionysius means the reveller. He is the one, brethren and sisters, who stood for the principle of eat, drink and be merry. But Luke tells us that he was an Areopagite. He was a supreme judge. And as far as status was concerned in Athens, Dionysius was right at the top. He was a chief official of the celebrated court of Athens. He was a key figure in that city. And the other person who was named is Damaris. Damaris, you may have already recognised, is very similar to the name Damascus. And as a matter of fact, they both come from the same root word, Damaso. And if you can transfer your mind back to Acts chapter 9, remember, Damaso means to tame, to discipline, to bring under a yoke, and hence to be gentle or control. Here is a woman whose name describes the attitude or the philosophy of the Stoics. Now the Stoics said, let us be disciplined. Let us tame human nature. Let us keep it controlled in order that a measure of morality and respectability might exist. So we have Dionysius the Epicurean and Damaris the Stoic. Now Damaris, you notice Luke tells us, and a woman named Damaris. I mentioned earlier on that according to Roman culture, according to them, it would be customary for them to say the men and the others, without mentioning the women. Right? In their life, there was only the men and others. In other words, women were of no reputation whatever in the Greek culture. So that here is a woman who was at the opposite end of the scale to Dionysius, who was the Areopagite. She was a woman worth nothing. Now we found that the Epicureans and the Stoics came together, and although they are diametrically opposed in their ideologies, they found it expedient to come together in order to contest with the truth. And after the battle, Luke is careful to tell us that they are still together because they now both mutually believe the truth. And so the gospel had its victory, brethren and sisters, in a way which is not numerically seen, but Luke is expecting us to have a spiritually perceptive mind to see the ramifications that were in the names of those two members of the Athenian ecclesia. Now, just the final word, the Apostle Paul at this stage was a very sick man. There is no doubt about that. We will look at this at the next class, God willing. His results were numerically small, but his encounter on Mars Hill was a complete success. But so we'll take up now, God willing, next time in Acts chapter 18, the occasion now how that Paul is sick, he is frustrated, dejected and depressed, and we're going to look, God willing, at chapter 18, which comes under the general theme, at the judgment seat. And this, of course, is a subject which is of profound interest to us all, at the judgment seat. And we're going to see that in a slightly different light from what we have been looking at previously, but a very interesting light.